From the Jesuits of Canada and the United States, this is AMDG. I'm Mike Jordan Lasky. There's an old saying in Jesuit circles: if you've met one Jesuit, you've met one Jesuit. This is certainly checked out in my 5 years of hosting this podcast. There's a bunch of unique guys in this big community we have. A fun list to make is all the different careers Jesuits had before joining the Society of Jesus. We have actors and comedians, doctors and lawyers, astronomers, and one former lieutenant governor. Shane Liesgang, my guest today, is the only Jesuit I've ever met who was a video game developer. Before entering the Jesuits in 2015, Shane worked for over a decade in video game design for a number of different studios. He worked on hugely popular games like the Fallout series and Skyrim. Shane was living his dream. But then he felt called to something more. Today, Shane is a Jesuit scholastic studying theology at Boston College's Clough School of Theology and Ministry. Shane didn't leave his entire gaming life behind when he entered the Jesuits, though. In fact, one of Shane's former employers, a hugely influential studio called Bethesda Game Studios, brought him back into the fold to work on a game called Starfield that was released in 2023. In this deeply complex space exploration game, the studio wanted to create a fictional religion that certain characters in the game would profess. So they asked Shane to write this religion's core texts, which are featured in several places in the game. I'm not a gamer myself, but I do see video game development as an art form. The combination of visual aesthetics, interactivity, and storytelling, not to mention the incredibly detailed and vast universes game developers make, all combine to elevate video games to something much more than a time waster. If you're skeptical about this claim, let Shane try to convince you in our conversation. We also talked about his unique vocation path and how game design is not dissimilar from Ignatian imaginative prayer in some crucial ways. This was an utterly fascinating conversation, and I think you'll really enjoy meeting Shane, whether you love video games or not. You can subscribe to AMDG wherever you get podcasts, and thanks for joining us. Shane Liesgang, welcome to AMDG. Thank you so much for taking the time. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time and excited to do so, because this will be our first episode ever that brings together the Jesuits, Ignatian spirituality, and video game design.
And yeah, those two things usually don't get mentioned together.
I know, but I do love like the sense that like you meet one Jesuit, they always say, if you've met one, you've met one Jesuit, and that Jesuits have done all kinds of things in their lives and have all kinds of interests and backgrounds. And so this is one that I'm just dying to learn more about. As I was saying to you before we started recording, I am not a gamer myself. So when we get into video game stuff, and I am sure this is some of our audience, this is the case, I'm just grateful in advance for you explaining it to me as if I sometimes say as if I were a five-year-old. I would say as if I were a five-year-old who didn't have access to video games, because there are certainly some five-year-olds who would know more than I know.
Well, over the last 9 years, I've explained video games to a lot of Jesuits, some of whom are in their 80s. So I've gotten used to how to package this in a way that I think people can understand it.
Nice. But I do come into this conversation, even though I'm not a gamer myself, I am not like a video game skeptic the way I think some folks are. We can get into this, you know. I do think it's an art form, especially now with the advancements in technology and just narrative. And for me, it seems like, as an outsider, if you want a place in the modern world to encounter beauty and story and just immersive, again, narrative that you can be in and play a role in, that video games are unique and just really an art form. And I think we'll try to make that case today. I'll ask you to try to make that case.
I'll do what I can.
Yeah, some experience. So before we get into all that, though, I do want to hear, you know, your vocation story, a little bit of it anyway, because it is a distinctive one, I think. They all are unique, but going from video game designer working for some really big studios on some really big games and then giving that up to join the Jesuits, for me, it warrants some investigation. So bring us into your, first of all, maybe start us, how did you get into video games design in the first place? How does one do that?
So I was a pretty big theater kid growing up, and that was something that I, especially in high school and college, devoted a lot of time and energy to. I was a very mediocre actor, but once I sort of came to terms with that, I became a lot more comfortable with directing and playwriting and realized, like, oh, there's this whole other side of the creative process here. Like most nerds as a kid, I was very into role-playing games, tabletop and video games, computer games, and that was just sort of a hobby for me. When I got to college, I was a theater major and a psychology major and a computer science minor. And those things all sort of come together in games, but this was not something I thought of as a thing I could do, really until my fourth year of school, my senior year. And I started taking some classes in the media studies department on sort of a critical approach to games and looking at them as art forms. And I sort of hit it off with one of the professors there. She became my mentor and kind of started encouraging me to say, like, you know, this is actually a thing people do, and that these are made by humans, and you're a human, you could do this. And so it's one of those things where, I was, like I said, I was very much into writing and creating characters and dialogue, and I had a decent ear for dialogue, but I, as a writer, like, I was never gonna make a living as a playwright, and even, Tony Award-winning playwrights still don't make a ton of money. And as a programmer, I was pretty good, like above average, but I was not a superstar, and I was never going to be that guy who, like, made his billions off of programming. But the fact that I could do both of those things made me useful in the games industry. The fact that I knew about story and character and how to create these things in an evocative way, but also knew enough about computers to build a system to tell these stories. Because it's not it's video games very much, they talk sometimes about cinema envy of, like, we want to have the same sort of cultural status as movies, and they're not quite there yet. But you see a lot of game designers who really just want to be filmmakers. The kinds of stories that I was working on in games tended to be much more what we call a player-owned story, which means you, as the player, are deciding what happens. It's not that you're sort of doing an interactive sequence where you fight something and then watching a scene play out. You're really deciding what you do, how the story plays out, what your relationships are with various characters, and all of that requires building a simulation, not just of the world, but of the sort of the social interactions and the interior of these characters' minds. And so it really st was really playing off all these things I had studied of how the human brain works, how emotions work, how a computer works, how drama works. And so I found my way into games. My first round of graduate school was at Carnegie Mellon, sort of in a program that focuses on people either tend to go into video games or theme park work or special effects, but sort of it was called entertainment technology. And yeah, that was sort of my real entryway, and from there I made my way into industry shortly right after that.
Yeah, I love that idea that it was like kind of your range that kind of brought you to the space. Because for me, as someone who's not a tech person, it's like, oh, video, that's a world that, like, since I don't know a huge amount about technology or like computer programming, I could kind of never be involved in. But the way you describe, like, kind of that piece, but then also your theater background and your psychology background, like, all kind of coming together, it's almost like this kind of perfect storm of a, I can see why you would be of interest to these studios.
And the games industry does have lots of very specialized people as well. I mean, I entered the industry a long time ago. I think they say these days you have fewer roles for people who are generalists like that. But it's sort of that mix of, I know enough about programming to talk to one of the best programmers in the world about how we want to do this, and then he or she could go off and make something amazing that I can appreciate, but I could never have built myself.
Sure. So maybe let's just take a second now then to some of the games you're describing, kind of like a person-led or a player-led game. And I can think of when I was a kid, I liked those kind of choose-your-own-adventure books, right? There, our 8-year-old daughter just got one from the library for the first time and is fascinated by it. Like, you read a little bit, and then you have a chance for a decision, and then you make a decision, and based on that, you go one way or another. And, you know, there are a few dozen options, you know, in these books, but they're pretty small. But I, as far as I understand it, some of these games you've worked on, just hundreds or thousands of choices, maybe even more. So, yeah, bring us into maybe by using one of the games you worked on as an example of what this means to kind of be someone who's exploring a world or making all these choices and what the goal is for a player.
So the big game that my friends tend to associate with me was called Skyrim, and that came out in 2011. And it's one of these, it's a very big, what's called an open world game. An open world means the player, we sort of drop you in the middle of a map and you can choose what direction you want to go and what sorts of stories you want to find. It's really, it's set in this sort of Viking inspired region of the world, of a fantasy world. There's dragons and elves, and it's in a lot of ways, it's kind of a standard fantasy sort of setting. But the fact that we were doing it in this Norse-inspired area kind of gave it a unique flavor, at least in 2011. And in this game, you know, you can, if you want to, be the Viking warrior and, you know, join your warrior clan and go and do jobs for them. You can also choose to go and study at the Wizards College and become the master wizard up there. I forget what the actual title is. You could be a thief. You can choose to save the world. You can be an assassin. And all of these options are there. I also have a friend who, when she plays the game, most of her time is spent going around picking flowers and mushrooms and making potions for people and selling them. And that is the game for her. And because the game sort of supports all of this, it means that you as the player can decide, well, what do I want to do in this world? The tagline, I think, for the game right before Skyrim in the series was live another life in another world. And so I think for me, one of the really powerful things about this is when you come into this at any, you know, when I sit down for an hour or two to play this game, I very much have the choice of like, what kind of experience do I want right now? Do I want something that is going to be action packed and full of like these big cinematic moments? Or do I want something where I'm just enjoying the physical beauty of this world and exploring it and or having more conversations with people and getting a sense of the history? So all of these options are there, and the player getting to choose at any moment what they want.
Sure. So that is like very different from like, you know, when I played on my original Nintendo console, like the, you know, Super Mario, where I'm running left to right and I'm jumping over things and I'm throwing stuff at things. And then I have a set goal. You know, I want to get to the end of this level or defeat certain, and then move on to the next one and then do that again. And it's harder the second time and then again and again. And then eventually you beat all the levels and all the bosses and you win.
Hooray.
Right. So this, that is like, I think, a traditional understanding of some of those games. So like how, in this case though, it seems like with all these, how do you, is there a winning or is it just, you're just in there doing stuff?
I mean, yeah. So in games made by this studio, which is Bethesda Game Studios, there's not really a single ending to it. There's something that there's like the main quest, the big story of the world. And you can reach the end of that storyline, but very intentionally and specifically, when you finish that main story, the world doesn't end. The world still exists. You still exist in it, and now you can go and pursue all those other things that maybe you weren't doing at any one time. And that's one of the challenges as creators in making this, because that choice can happen at any point. So, you know, like when I was there, I was working on this one storyline, this one set of stories. And at any point in the middle of it, the player can get bored with it and decide they want to go do something else. And the game supports that. But that means my story has to make sense when you come back to it. And it has to be structured in such a way that it can be broken apart and put back together by the player. And so that's a little different from a much more linear story that that something like cinema tells or a TV show or even a lot of video games tend to be much more linear. But when you're doing an open world narrative game like that, They're sort of what I think of as narrative engineering that has to happen. It's not just being able to write a good story, but being able to write a good story that can be broken apart.
Sure. Gosh. And so if you were to sit down in a game, say like Skyrim, as you're describing, and you have the main quest, and then you decide you want to go get some flowers and mushrooms to make potions, and how much world is there to explore? Like, how many hours of gameplay are we talking?
Oh.
If you wanted to go out and see everything, could you see everything? I am just trying to think of what are the limits on this universe.
I mean, in terms of narrative content, I think there's probably a few hundred hours in Skyrim. I mean, I played all of it at some point, just in the course of making it, but I don't remember the exact amount, but it's on that order of just substantial amounts of content. And then in terms of seeing the physical world, because there's all these just places to find that don't necessarily have narrative attached to them, but might be gorgeous. And for a lot of people, it's just finding this cool vantage point, or seeing, like, if you get to the northern parts of it, you'll actually get like an aurora in the sky. You don't always get it, though. So for some people, they're like trying to find the spot where that'll show up.
And in terms of just that, like a map of how...
Oh, I forget the exact proportions of how long it would take
massive.
To walk across. Yeah, it's big. It's called a province within the world. I forget exactly how big it is, but it would take you quite a while in game to walk from one end to the other.
Right. Sure. Okay. Cool. So you were involved in that game and some others. I'm sure these massive teams of people, as you're describing, like all the people.
Skyrim was about 100 people.
100 people.
Which is small for a game that size. That's just the development team. Then there's marketing and support staff beyond that.
But sure.
The development team was about 100, which is small given that.
So you're doing that. Bring us into your life now outside of the game around that time. And again, trying to help us like trace that path for you from doing that, which sounds exciting and really cool, and what you had kind of been building toward and studied, to kind of leaving that behind.
Yeah. If you had asked the 12-year-old Shane what he wanted to be doing, I was doing exactly that. And it's something that that I really enjoyed and I still really enjoy. But I think I had started to get more interested and more involved in sort of political things, looking at sort of systems of poverty, systems of individual rights, and how society worked in a way that benefited some people and didn't benefit others. And because I'm a game designer, my brain sees everything in systems. And so all these tools that I developed to learn how to build fake systems, I started sort of turning them inside out and applying them to the real world and seeing sort of injustice and that kind of thing there. And I started to have this instinct inside of me of wanting to do something about these problems. And at the time I had grown up Catholic. I was, I had been kind of away from the church for a while. I had come back, but I was not sort of all in. But this was stirring. There was something kind of moving there. And I remember having this instinct a couple times of like, I wish there was a way that I could do these sorts of things, and maybe even kind of like give my life to it, but I don't want to be a priest. But is there a way I could do this without the religious aspect? I was living in DC at the time, which is where that studio is based, or in the DC area. And so I started to think, maybe, you know, is there something I could do in politics? Is there something I could work for an NGO? I kind of fished around for a little bit in the area to see what kind of options there were. Because I have no background in these things, there's not a lot that I could have done. I had this really strong instinct when I was watching the protests in Ferguson in 2014, I think it was. Having this really strong instinct to say, I want to go there. I want to be involved somehow. But then in my mind, going through the thought process of, okay, do you have any legal training? No. Do you have any medical training? No. Do you have any experience with community organizing? No. What could I do? I would just be one more well-intentioned white person showing up trying to do something and realizing that there's not much I could do there. And the one of the things I really remember, I'm going on a little long here, I'm sorry, is there was a website at the time, shortly after Skyrim came out, where people would send in screenshots of the game along with like something they did in the game that they were like embarrassed about or excited about. And sometimes they would connect it to their real life, and it was a fun thing to read. And I remember very distinctly there was one that it was a shot of the night sky in the game, and the caption just said, "For the last year, this game is the only thing that kept me from taking my own life." And I just remember being really moved by that, but also thinking like, okay, in some very small way, you know, part of a 100-person team making something 5 years later, this person has an experience with it. Like in so many levels of indirection, but in some very tiny way, I helped save this person's life, and thinking, are there ways for me to do that more directly? And to be with people, to help people in a way that I'm more present with them and more directly affecting. And I moved to Los Angeles for a different job, and I started to get involved in a parish community there that turned out to be just a phenomenally good young adult faith community. And I remember there was a point I was at work and I realized I was rushing through my work to get to a church thing, and had that moment of saying, oh, maybe I should be putting more energies into this thing over here that's feeding me, and as opposed to this thing that's not. But I didn't know who the Jesuits were. I never went to a Jesuit school, much less a Catholic school. And I was vaguely aware of they run Georgetown and that kind of thing, but I didn't know who it was. And it was, the timeline is a little off here, but, when Pope Francis got elected in 2013, my friend asked me, so why is it a big deal this new Pope is a Jesuit? And I said, oh, let me look into that and get back to you. And all of this sort of desire to be more of use, this sort of growing connection to my spirituality, all of this was sort of coming together at the same time. I literally opened the Jesuits Wikipedia page to answer my friend's question about why is it a big deal that the Pope is a Jesuit? And through the first thing that kind of hooked me was the work that the Jesuits do, working with people on the margins, with refugees, that sort of thing, sort of expanding the idea of what it means to be church. And I said, this is really interesting. And then through that, I found Jesuit spirituality, and having had a creative career before, getting to use my imagination in prayer was like this absolute revelation. I was like, wow, that's not cheating. I'm allowed to do that. But the first Jesuit I actually met was the vocation director after I filled out a form on a website saying, I think I might want to be a Jesuit.
Wow. So there wasn't even one who kind of invited you. It was
I invited myself.
Showed up like, hey. When you're doing that and then pursuing that and making that transition, were your friends or your colleagues in game design, was that, I imagine, a pretty surprising move?
Yeah. Most people had no idea. Because it doesn't come up at work. It probably shouldn't come up a lot of the times in an office. But some of my fairly close colleagues, when they found out I was going to become a Jesuit, their first response was like, oh, I didn't even know you were religious. And actually I am. Because it's not a topic of conversation most of the time. And I would say a lot of people were very, very supportive. And then a lot of people sort of came out of the woodwork, and I found out very quickly who was religious among my old colleagues, but it had just never come up before.
Sure. So was there something though you felt like you were giving up? Was that or once you decided, did you feel like, you know, this is the right place? I can imagine, again, you had become successful in this field that's very competitive, making things that people love. What was that interiorly for you as you were making that transition?
I mean, like I said, I really liked that work, and it's still sort of my default form of creative expression. I still make little things on the side when I have time. But I think because I was very lucky and got to work on some very successful projects, I was early on able to say like, well, I've kind of done most of what I want to do here. And when I looked at my heroes in the industry, I would see a lot of people like in their 50s, trying to reproduce some success they had when they were in their 20s, and saying like, do I want to be that? And kind of saying like, okay, well, I could do this for the rest of my life, but do I want to keep doing this? It's not a bad thing. I have a lot of friends still in the industry. But for me, I had realized like, this is not what I want to be doing. And there were still games that I had ideas for and I wanted to make, but they were all very, honestly, very social justice-y, very non-commercial. And so there was, it was the sort of thing where I said, even if I do this well, which is a big if, you know, the idea, the gap between ideas and execution is huge. Even if I were to execute it extremely well, this would not make much money. And so just kind of saying like, okay, what, I still like this. I don't need it to be a livelihood though. I don't need my identity to be connected with it in such a way. What I have found is my identity continues to be connected with it, because when people introduce me, they say, oh, this is my friend Shane. He used to be a game developer and now he's a Jesuit. Or within the Jesuits, like that, you know, everybody kind of has their thing right. that they get introduced as. This is Shane, the former game developer. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we get a chance to talk more so we can see that you're just so much more than that, you know, even though that's what we've been talking about.
Indeed, indeed.
And I, there is something you brought up that I wasn't thinking about asking, but now that you've mentioned, again, the sense of like when you were having then some of these instincts toward being involved in social justice causes, this pull toward the Jesuits, maybe like, oh, thinking, oh, maybe I could, you could make games that were, you know, kind of justice oriented. And I know that like because of the popularity of games, you know, folks, even in religious circles, I'm sure in justice circles, you think of like, can we gamify some of these experiences? I know Loyola Press, the Jesuit ministry has kind of developed a game connected to St. Ignatius and discipleship. And I'm sure that's happening more. Even when I used to work in social justice, there were like these very simple kind of choose your own adventure online games. Mm-hmm. One about like trying to simulate what it meant to be the choices you had to make living in poverty, you know, kind of text-based games that you would make a choice about what you would spend money on that month and kind of experience it that way. What is your take on some of these other spaces using game, like with a very particular purpose in mind, as opposed to kind of creating, you know, something beautiful, but who, that have like a didactic purpose. Do you see that growing? I'm sure it's growing, but yeah, just curious for your take on when those two worlds come together very specifically.
I mean, one of the things that I was saying, especially as the as I was sort of taking this turn and getting more interested in social justice causes, I remember thinking, you know, every game is teaching you something, whether it wants to or not. You're learning even just the physical skills to manipulate the controller to make it do things on the screen. But you're learning how the systems of the game work. If you're playing Final Fantasy or something, you have to understand the magic system and you have to understand the experience system. And it's this basically behind the scenes, it's this huge spreadsheet that you're having to learn how to manipulate. And so every game is teaching you something. The Assassin's Creed games actually teach you a lot about history in sort of their own strange way. And so if every game is teaching you something, I remember having the thought of like, well, why can't we make sure it's teaching something that's worth knowing? I think a lot of people have learned about very specific details about guns from playing Call of Duty. And yeah, that's a perfectly fine game. It's not my thing. But I don't think more people need to know details of military hardware. So could we teach something that's a little more edifying? The trick is the more didactic a game gets, the more it turns people off. And so it's like how to thread that needle is very difficult. And it's the same way you see like most Christian rock is not very good. The way most religiously themed movies are very simple and just not generally not great. There's exceptions and But when I first entered, I had some people say, oh, like, do you want to do religiously themed games? And I just thought, ugh, I don't trust myself enough to do it well.
Sure.
Is the thing.
So since you are so much more than a former video game designer, tell us just briefly a little bit about what you've done. I know you've had a chance to be in the Middle East and working with refugees. And so getting to participate in some of those, you know, ministries that you had described, being close with people. What have you done in your Jesuit formation so far?
I mean, that's one of the things that just amazed me and continues to amaze me about the Jesuits is how basically from day one as a novice, well, maybe day 14 of those first 2 weeks or whatever. But from very early on as a novice, they had me doing the work. I was out at one of the state prisons in California, helping run retreats out there with some of the men. I was meeting weekly with little juvenile felons up at one of the spots, kids who are getting tried as adults. So just very quickly sort of encountering people I never would have met before. Mm. Working in a hospital, the level 2 trauma center in Watts in LA. And that, you know, a place where I walk in a collar and everyone's emotions float right to the surface and they want to talk about big things. And then, yeah, it, being in the Middle East, I was there for 2 years as my regency, working with the Jesuit Refugee Service. I was based in Beirut, and then at the regional office, so I was also working across Jordan and Iraq and working with teams in Syria, but I couldn't myself go to Syria as an American. But the, you know, what I remember driving around Kurdistan with a French colleague, later that day, we would go to one of our project offices and work with some of the team out there, but we're also going to this old Sumerian aqueduct or hiking up to an old Saddam Hussein's old palace. Or, you know, I'm at this Yazidi temple drinking tea with these random, like, just the sorts of things that I absolutely had no conception I could ever do when I lived most of my life sitting in front of a keyboard.
Hmm. So as part of this, of your formation, you have been approached to be involved in game design in different ways, kind of fitting that into in between all kinds of things. And the, I think what led to our conversation now is that you were involved in another big Bethesda Studios game, Starfield, which came out last year.
Yep.
At this point. And we're involved in writing a religion for the one of the societies in these games. So yeah, tell us what you can about that experience. How did you get back in there? How are you able to make time for it? And then what actually was your work? What went into it?
So Starfield was a game that, while I was still at Bethesda, it was sort of in its most embryonic stage. We knew that, you know, we were working on Skyrim. The next game was going to be Fallout. There was something else after that. But there was this thing on the horizon that Todd Howard, the director of the studio, had sort of been thinking about. He wanted to make what we were just calling it the space game. So I was in some of those very initial conversations about, you know, what does it mean to be a space game? There's lots of space games. What makes ours different? But it was literally the very, very beginnings of that project. It did not develop any further while I was there. When I took vows, which was 2017. So I had finished 2 years of the novitiate. I became a vowed Jesuit, and I was about to go to New York to start my philosophy studies. My old head writer was in Los Angeles for a meeting where our novitiate is. It was like in those 3 days between taking vows and moving. And he said, "Hey, I'm in LA. Do you want to get a drink?" And I met up with him, and we're chatting and just catching up. And he just kind of mentions, "Hey, you remember the space game?" I said, "Oh yeah." He said, "Well, we've been developing the ideas for it." And he said, it's actually kind of, there's some theological aspects to it now. Would you be willing to talk about that and help with that? And at first I thought it was a trick. I was like, are you kidding? But hell yeah, I wanted to help with that. I had to get permission from my superiors, of course. Over the next couple years, I would have occasional talks with some of my old friends on the design team. And some of them were centered around, like, Shane, you're someone who very much believes in science and loves the rational approach to the world. How do you also believe in God? And these were sort of off the record conversations with them, some over email, some over chat. But just sort of helping them to see, like, here's a worldview that can embrace space exploration, but also believe in God. And we went back and forth on these sorts of things. They were all always, like, you know, some were to different degrees of religious, or they had grown up religious and not anymore, or had never really had faith. Some were very religious, and sort of being able to be in that space and talk to all of them and get them to understand, like, here is a way to understand the universe. And in the course of one of these conversations, they said, well, you know, in the game, we want to have this religious group, and we want it to be real. We want it to feel real. We don't want these people to be caricatures. We don't want them to be, you know, superstitious idiots. We want this to feel something like it's something legitimate. Could you help develop that? And so at that point, they said, could you actually write some texts for this game, for this fake religion? And I was like, well, I had to think through that, because there's the question, like, what I don't want is the headline of Jesuit creates new religion, right? which is not the case. So what I ended up doing for them is I wrote a very philosophical approach to a spiritual understanding of the universe. So it's what we might call natural theology, which is sort of approaching ideas of God, but without a specific faith commitment, sort of from a purely philosophical level. And this is the kind of thing that like Aristotle did before any Christian context existed. But this notion of a sort of oneness of God and the nature of existence, that then Aquinas would take and transform into scholastic theology. And so I was able to write kind of from a more philosophy of religion perspective, and what does it mean to believe that there is something beyond our reality, while still being someone who wants to dive deeply into reality.
So then what goes into that? So you kind of have some of these ideas, and then, so like, what are you writing? What are you putting together for this game? And then how is it used within the universe of the game?
So in most Bethesda games, there are books in the world that you can take and read.
Literally like click something or tap on something, like, and then
it's a book in, you see the book in the game, you click on it and it opens up, and then you can turn the pages. It is not a full book typically. Mm-hmm. Like when I would write a book for Skyrim, a long one might be like 1,000 words. And most were maybe 300 to 500. But the idea is that, like, you know, I wrote a book that was like the history of this group that I was working on, or one of the histories. And the idea is that sort of, it's like an impressionist painting. It's like this sort of gestures towards the more complete text that you might imagine.
Sure.
So for Starfield, I wrote they asked for a sort of the foundational texts. So in my mind, it's like the beginning of this character who starts this religion, sort of the beginning of his Summa Theologica, sort of building an idea of the divine using very specific philosophical language. And then they asked for like a recruitment text, the kind of thing that a street preacher would hand you. Because it's me, I still wrote it very philosophically, but the idea is, you know, like maybe that appeals to people. And then they had me write some of his personal journals as well. It was specifically his personal journals during a big time of discernment. So I was drawing a lot on St. Ignatius and the writings that he made during a time of discernment. I with that in particular, I sort of laced Ignatian terms in a light way. I think a Jesuit would read it and know exactly what I was doing. I think someone who went to one of our schools might recognize something. I think most people would not. But I think that's really the only way I know how to write discernment. It's because it's what I've learned. It's what I've practiced. It's what I've spent so much time praying with. Right. So if you ask me to write a spiritual character doing discernment, I'm like, well, here we go.
Are you able to share like any quotes or anything more specific from it at all?
It's long. I'm looking at it right now on my other screen here.
Yeah.
There's this one, the volume one text, I was actually really happy with this because, the opening line is all people by nature desire to know, which is also the opening line of Aristotle's Metaphysics. I take that and sort of, because I'm speaking sentence fragments now, because this is a difficult thing to articulate. Right. I think for most people playing this game, and probably for most modern people, you don't have to make the sell. Well, you do eventually have to make the sell, but the question is not Jesus per se. The question is not the Trinity. The question is not, or at least the first questions are not these things. The question is like, why should I believe in God at all? What is like God has done nothing for me. There's no kind of, I don't see any supernatural things. They might have some very negative experience with religion. And so the text kind of says, explicitly says, throw out everything you think you know about God. Start from nothing. And ask yourself the sort of human instinct to know things. And sometimes that's sort of scientific knowledge, and sometimes that's emotional knowledge. Sometimes that's just getting to know your neighbors. Sometimes that's how to do your job more effectively. But there's always this desire to know more. And that's not original to me. Again, that's Aristotle. But the idea is that the more you try to know, eventually you hit this, what we call it, the epistemic barrier, beyond which there's simply things you cannot know. And you reach this point where you're asking things like, well, why does anything exist at all? Why is there something instead of nothing? And, you know, I love science, and the in-game person who's writing this loves science. But there are questions that science is simply not equipped to answer, and things like, why is there anything at all? And I think people, as you start to get closer to that barrier, if somebody has very strong scientific commitments or atheist commitments, they get nervous. And so I say, we'll get as close as we can to this, and then acknowledge that, you know, if you may not care about the answers to those questions anymore, but they still exist. And just getting somebody to the point where it's understanding that, like, these questions still exist, and how far are you willing to carry them? And so basically I'm trying to walk people through getting them to a space where they're willing to accept that there is something beyond our understanding of reality. Now the move that I don't make in this text is to a Christian understanding of God. God is love, which from there you can derive the Trinity and the Incarnation and all kinds of things. But I kind of am just sticking with the idea of like, well, there is something that underlies all of reality. And that is something that we can think about and talk about. So while I say like this text is not explicitly Christian, I feel like it could serve as a good chapter one for kind of a transcendental theology textbook.
Sure.
It's sort of making a move that like Karl Rahner or Elizabeth Johnson would make of understanding God in this specific way as the ground of being. I have been throwing a lot of philosophical terms out, and I feel like you can edit this down to make it less brainy as much as you want.
No, that's great. I mean, and so maybe could you bring me like on the user path, you know, so a player is playing, and I know maybe you described to me before we started recording it, there's a kind of a funeral scene in which we can encounter some of your text in this way. So maybe, yeah. So what is then someone's interaction besides maybe just opening a book that they can come across? Like, what are some ways in which what you worked on gets lived out in the context of the game?
So this religious group, it's called the Sanctum Universum, which is Latin for the blessed universe or the holy universe. They exist in the world, and you'll encounter their members. They have sort of a little church is not the right word, but they have a building on the main human city in this one planet. And the founder is still alive, the one who wrote these texts, and you meet him and you talk to him. I don't want to spoil the main quest for anyone who hasn't played that far, but it does factor into the main story. If you play through the entirety of the main story of the game, you will meet this guy, you will read his texts, you will find his journals, so all of this is put in front of the player. How much they choose to read of it and engage with it is sort of up to them, but it is at least thrown in front of them. And then you mentioned the funeral scene, which I think most people who play the game will run into this funeral scene. And one of the characters, when he gives his eulogy, he says, I'm not very good with words, but I just want to quote something that's meaningful to me. And he verbatim takes one of those texts. So as much as like when I lurk on the internet and try to see what people are saying about religion and Starfield, like that is one that comes up. People say like, where did this quote come from? And then somebody says, it's actually from one of the texts. And then they will go off from there.
Yeah. Just again, the level of detail and creating this universe, it just is so beyond, you know, again, any kind of elementary understanding of what it means to be in a video game.
Oh, yeah.
So that's maybe this is a good transition point. So like, again, I mentioned at the beginning, like, you know, I think there would be some, including maybe some of our listeners, who would say video games, it's a waste of time. This is just like it's a time suck where you live your whole life on the computer. If you should be out in the world, or if you want to encounter art, then go to a museum or read a book or watch a film. I want you to kind of take me down a notch as this, hypothetical interlocutor who I'm sure you've met, especially in
many
religious
times.
Well, yeah, like this is a waste. Like, why is this important? So maybe as someone who, again, has this experience as a Jesuit and has now kind of brought them together too, and part of your life, but, for you, what is the value? Why are video games, could we consider them an art form? What's your best argument against those who would kind of turn up their noses?
Yeah, I think, and this is actually something that many years ago, Roger Ebert, the film critic, who I love as a film critic, he actually got himself into trouble with the games community because he made the statement that games were not art, as he understood it, and people jumped on him for this. But he was actually saying something kind of interesting. He was not just dismissing them as like, oh, they're not good enough to be art or something like that. He was making this argument about because the player has a role in it, it's not because there's a shared authorship that it lacked the kind of, for him, authorship was constitutive for art. So he felt like the fact that it was a collaboration meant that it lacked a certain vision that he insisted on, which I might still disagree with, but it's a much more interesting thing to disagree with.
Right.
And I think that's where I would start in the discussion of like, are these worthwhile? Is when you watch someone play a video game, it might look like garbage. It might look like a waste of time, because it's like if I were to watch any action movie that is just the action scenes. That's usually what the experience they get watching someone else play a video game. Mm-hmm. And you're missing sort of the moments in between where there's characters, but you also don't have the experience of doing it. And I think that's where games are inherently unique, is by being experiential. Your choices matter, not just sort of the broad scale narrative choices, but moment to moment, like which direction you're facing, which thing you're interacting with, what perspective you have, which character you choose, like everything you're doing is your choice. And I think that's where, as an art form, like giving that sense of, I think one of the best things in general that we can teach people is that your choices matter, and that you always have choices. And games, I think, better than any other medium, can actually give you that, because you have to make the choice yourself. It's obviously in this very artificial context, but that means it also gives you space to experiment with choices you might not make in real life. You can play an evil character. You can do things that are not within your own moral code. And maybe that has a cathartic purpose of getting those things out of your system. But maybe it also lets you develop a sense of empathy for why somebody might make a choice that is different from yours. And I think that's where games at their best can really help people develop empathy for another person. And I think a lot of that comes to the experience of being in a world in another person's perspective. So there's games where if you have a choice of what kind of character you play as, and if you are playing as a black character, people react to you differently. If you're playing as a woman, people react to you differently. And that's something where, I can watch movies that show those perspectives, and I can watch TV shows that show those perspectives. But when I feel my own choices being limited, it can cause people to reflect. I'll admit most games don't play in that space, but there's a potential there. And I think that's where it starts to get really interesting, of like how we teach and what sorts of experiences we give people.
Sure. I am, I guess, curious, in this experience you've had kind of getting back into this world in the biggest way since you entered the Jesuits, was anything different for you when you were approaching the work, or when you were approaching the game? You talked earlier about kind of how as a Jesuit or a person of faith, or looking at the world, you all about systems and how like your experience in games has kind of shaped the way you see the world. And I'm curious now how your experience like in the Jesuits has kind of shaped the way you see games or approach this work. Just curious about like any kind of spirituality you brought to it that might have been different than when you were working on games 15 years ago.
I mean, the stuff that I wrote for Starfield, and I should also make the point that I did very, very little work on Starfield. For me, it was a big thing, but in terms of what is actually in the game, it's a very tiny percentage of it.
Sure.
But the work that I did on Starfield, I think I would not have been able to do if I had not studied philosophy for 3 years and had not been specifically doing so in a context of being avowed religious and always sort of turning everything towards understanding God. So when I'm learning Aristotle, Aquinas, Kant, Descartes, all these folks, for me, it's always about how does this help me understand God more? And honestly, I think more of it goes in the other direction, where I think my understanding of God has been informed by my work on video games, in terms of, you know, creating a world and putting people in it and giving them things that I want them to do. And sometimes they don't do the things I want them to do. And how do I feel about that? And understanding that the affection that I have for the world that I've created might be very strong, but it is infinitely smaller than the love God has for this world. It's the same way musicians think God is a musician and architects think God is an architect. I think there's part of me that sees, I don't think we live in a video game or anything like that, but see sort of those lines getting drawn.
Yeah, no, that's a beautiful way of thinking about that. Like any kind of, I know when I've had that creative work, I really feel kind of plugged in, or especially for me, like, playing music with friends. Yeah, I'm no expert musician, but there is something about sharing in that space that you can feel drawn beyond yourself to something ineffable, you know, that you can't describe. And the sense of kind of throwing yourself into kind of creating this world and seeing it and being proud of it. That's a really interesting analog to the creator, and that human instinct too, to create, to participate in that as created in the image and likeness of God. So that's fascinating. I'm trying to think, like, we've been talking a long time. I feel like I could keep asking you questions about a lot of these things, but maybe one last question, specifically about Ignatian spirituality, because you mentioned earlier too, the role of the imagination, and that we are encouraged by Ignatius to like put ourselves into a gospel scene and to use our senses and our imaginations to pray. And that is not just, that it's not cheating, as you had said earlier. But just like how for you as a creative person, Ignatian spirituality kind of makes sense to you. Maybe some more Jesuit specific stuff in this last bit here.
I mean, I think when I did the spiritual exercises as a novice, for people who don't know, the spiritual exercises are the 30-day silent retreat, where you're doing a very structured set of prayers every day, set of sort of meditations, contemplations on various things that Ignatius has specified. And a lot of it, I think the majority of it, are contemplations on the life of Christ, usually taken directly from one of the Gospels. And for me, the way we're asked to enter into that is by imagining sort of sensory details of what did the scene look like? What did it smell like? What is the texture of something you're touching? And just sort of to find these sensory details that kind of zap you in. And I think for me, I had so many experiences of placing myself into a virtual world that it was very easy for me to visually construct the world around me and sort of say, okay, if I'm at the Last Supper and we're doing the washing of the feet, I can see that very easily. But finding the thing that sort of brought me actually in usually ended up being a more sensory detail. For me, it was like the way the water sloshed in the bucket as he was walking around, just that physical sense of like the weight shifting of the water. But I think the way my brain has been so trained to place itself in a different context constantly, I think helped me very quickly get into some of those contemplations. And I would have very visual experiences sometimes it's bringing my imagination to it. I had never been to the Holy Land at the time I was doing this. So there's a lot of details I was just making up. But I think being prepared, and some of that goes back to my theater training of just sort of the yes and the ability to sort of go with where your imagination is taking you at any moment, sort of let me just trust how the Holy Spirit was leading me in those moments.
Hmm. Well, Shane, thank you so much for all of this. This has been a really fascinating conversation. I really loved it, and I think
my pleasure
will too. And blessings on the rest of your time in theologate and in your study and all the other things you're up to these days.
Thank you so much.
AMDG is a production of the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the United States and recorded at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. The show is edited by Marcus Bleach. Our theme music is by Kevin Lasky. The Jesuit Conference communications team is Marcus Bleach, Eric Clayton, Megan Leepsch, Becky Sindelar, and me. Connect with the Jesuits online at jesuits.org, on Twitter at Jesuit News, Instagram at We Are the Jesuits, and facebook.com/Jesuits. Sign up for weekly email reflections by visiting jesuits.org/weekly. If you or someone you know might be called to discern a vocation with the Jesuits, connect with a Jesuit vocation promoter at beajesuit.org. Drop us an email with questions or comments at media@jesuits.org. You can subscribe to AMDG on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as St. Ignatius of Loyola may or may not have said, go and set the world on fire.